Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to those who know that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are rotten to the core, that they are the problem, and that therefore there is no religious, political, or military solution to any of the problems that ail our planet. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is perpetrating these crimes, to understand why they are doing so. And as a result, in our second hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, because its covenant provides the only reliable answer. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, and we have a returning guest today. His name is John Guandolo. You can participate in a conversation with him toll-free, 877-300-7645. Many of you may remember that, at least 6 months ago, maybe even longer, we had a former FBI agent on the line, and I'm going to let John in a minute here share his background with us to bring us up to speed, who had left the FBI and had begun studying the root cause of terrorism. And we were in the midst of a conversation with him. I think it went the entire first hour of the program, but still had lots of ground to cover once the conversation ended. John has written a new book. It is called Raising a Jihadi Generation. It is available at Amazon or also from his site, which is understandingthethreat.com. Welcome back, John.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. John, why don't you share a little bit of your background? You don't come at this position lightly. You've had a lot of experience in the field of both espionage and terrorism and working on the front lines of the judicial system.
Okay. Well, I guess the moderately short bio of me would be I'm a 1989 graduate of the Naval Academy. I served for about 6.5 years as an officer in the Marine Corps, as an infantry and reconnaissance officer. I served in combat. And in 1996, I resigned my commission, joined the FBI as a special agent, and spent about 12.5 years in the FBI. And while there, among the things I did, I was a counterterrorism agent. And because of a series of investigations and things I did, came to understand the Muslim Brotherhood movement here in the United States, and realizing that a lot of people in the Bureau were not aware of it, I created the first training program on the Muslim Brotherhood, Sharia, and jihadi organizations working to achieve the goal of spreading Sharia, imposing it. And in 2008, I actually was recruited by the Department of Defense out of the FBI to do strategic analysis of this threat, where I worked for a while, and then just a little over a year ago created my own private national security consulting firm, and I continue to brief and advise members of Congress and senior military and government officials, as well as elected officials at the local and state level, governors, attorney generals, and such like that.
One of the great problems in America, John, I think probably even in the West, is this ritualistic knee-jerk tendency to say that we're at a war against either a tactic, terrorism, or at war against Al-Qaeda, which is all but defunct as an organization around the world. You at least take the battle to the birthplace of Al-Qaeda, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. But why not all the way to Islam?
Well, you can. As a national security consultant, the reality of the situation on the ground is that if we crush the Muslim Brotherhood and the related parallel movements like Tabliki Jamaat-e Islami, you've taken away all their essentially their power base of the current Islamic movement. But to your point, it is a matter of fact, undisputed fact, by the way, that that starting at the first grade level, Islam teaches in textbooks, in their doctrinal books, and at the national and international level, that Islam is a complete way of life governed by Islamic law. So social, cultural, military, political, and religious, all governed by Islamic law. Sharia, 100% of all published Islamic law states that the purpose of Islam is to wage jihad, which 100% of Islamic law only defines as warfare against non-Muslims, that the purpose of Islam is to wage jihad until the entire world is under the control of Sharia.
And, you know, why does Sharia law say such things?
Well, Sharia mandates that Sharia be the only law of the land itself, and Islam requires it to be imposed because, according to Islam, the mandates in Sharia came from Allah through the revelations to Muhammad, which makes up what is in the Quran, and Muhammad himself, who's the perfect example of a Muslim, according to Islam, he repeated that jihad is an obligation until the entire world is under the power of Sharia, and he actually waged many battles against non-Muslims in order to impose Islamic law.
Yeah, 75 of them. Actually, yeah. Islamic law didn't exist during the time of Muhammad. It is a Sharia law. While Muslims will tell you that it is based on the Quran, probably 1% of Sharia law is actually based on the Quran. 99% of Sharia law is based upon the words and deeds of Muhammad, as they are comprised in what's called the Sunnah. And the Sunnah is comprised entirely of Hadith. So to understand the basis of Islamic law, we have to look at the Hadith, which are the oral reports from Muhammad and his companions, which are the only sources of information on him compiled within 250 years of his death. And in those documents, which you say is correct, in the range of 99.9% of what the Hadith reports about the life and words, the deeds and words of Muhammad, they focus on what we would consider to be grotesquely immoral things. Jihad, mass murder, thievery, kidnap, the slave trade, all the kinds of things that we see Muslims doing today. One of the things that's interesting, of course, about the jihad and the Quran, John, I'm sure you know, is that in the ninth surah of the Quran, the Muslims are told that they have a license to lie, that you can form a treaty with a Muslim group, a Muslim nation, and the treaty is not binding on them. It's only binding on you.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's called the Treaty of Hudaybiyah.
I think the reason this is important, that particular piece, is when we work with leaders of the Muslim community in the United States, we are working with exclusively leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. And when we know, as a matter of fact, that they state that Sharia is what they seek to impose and it's also their blueprint for how they operate, then we know that they are, in fact, obliged to lie to us if it furthers their cause. And, of course, it does. And that creates a pretty strong dichotomy of who we think we're believing and who we think we're getting good information from. And as we actually talked about the last time I was on the show, is that our domestic counterterrorism policy, as well as our international, you know, our foreign policy, is being guided by these Islamic advisors to the president, to the national security staffs, Department of Homeland Security, who do not have our best interests in mind. And so, as we've talked about before, while there are people, individuals, who self-identify themselves as being Muslim, who do not necessarily subscribe to Sharia, that's not, as a national security consultant, that's not my business. That's fine if they do or don't. I'm not here to judge them. What is an actual threat are individuals who are leaders of organizations with substantial influence who openly seek to overthrow our constitutional republic and impose Sharia. And whether we as citizens or individuals in leadership think that it's possible or not, and I would argue it's very possible based on the status of where their movement is. The bottom line is that's still a threat that has to be addressed. Not only are we not, our leadership in the national security apparatus, not addressing it, we are actually continuing to assist these individuals, give them access not only to our data systems inside our national security agencies, but give them influence and a say as to what this government does with regards to these threats. And that's not reasonable. Yeah. That's not a sane response.
Yeah, see, I don't think the problem, though, is an improper designation of the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, but the unwillingness of America's leadership, and I don't care where you look, whether it's political leadership, academic leadership, or the spokespeople in the media, or even in the military, there's an absolute unwillingness, because it's typically a career-ending move, to identify terrorism with Islam. And so, because the Muslim Brotherhood is clearly an Islamic organization, they don't want to make the connection between Islam and terrorism, so they don't make the connection between the Muslim Brotherhood and terrorism.
You are absolutely correct. And the fact of the matter is, I can, you know, spend an entire hour or 10 just relating to stories in the last 10 years of my experiences of briefing three-star, four-star generals and admirals, members of Congress, former directors of FBI, CIA, senior officials inside the government who not only do not know this, when the facts are laid on the table and you say, here's what Islamic law says, here are 20 books of Islamic law published from the 10th century, 12th century, all the way to today, published in English, and here's what they say. And oh, by the way, you'll notice they all say the exact same thing. And you have the Muslim Brotherhood stating that in the A or several particular books of Islamic law, they say these are good, these are authoritative, and they say exactly what you and I are talking about right now. You have an easily identifiable factual threat that is saying this is what it is. This is what Islamic law says, and there's no such thing as an Islam that does not mandate Sharia to be imposed on the whole world, and there is no such thing as an Islamic law that does not define jihad as warfare against non-Muslims. And so you're left with, what do you do with that?
John, we'll be back after the commercial break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with John Guandolo. John has written a book called Raising a Jihadi Generation. It is available at Amazon.com or at UnderstandingTheThreat.com. John, we were in the midst of talking about something that I find to be among the most important issues related to the survival of the West. Which is not just a reluctance, but an absolute aversion by those in power, whether they be the media, they be law enforcement, that be the military, or politicians, to associate Islam with terrorism. And therefore, when you talk to them, you said that you could share stories about how they respond so negatively. If your presentation accurately presents the facts, irrefutable facts, that Islam is the enemy, not a tactic.
I will start with this little vignette or story for your audience.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Is, you know, I teach, part of what I do is I have a 3-day program for law enforcement, military, intelligence professionals. And a couple years ago, 2011, I did one, actually did two, a few months apart at headquarters, Marine Corps in Arlington, Virginia. And the story I actually inserted right before I published the book, I inserted it in the front at the request of several people who said, you know, this story really tells, you know, paints a picture for people getting ready to read the book. And the story, very briefly, is this, is we had about 115 professionals. You name the agency, they were there. FBI, CIA, DHS, NSA. You had state and local law enforcement from all over the Washington, D.C., Maryland area. We had some from even farther away than that. We had military special operations people there. We had literally people from the FBI's National Joint Terrorism Task Force. And on the third day, a guy stood up in front of everyone. Mm-hmm. And he said this. He said, John, I am a supervisor at FBI headquarters. I've been in the FBI for over 14 years, mm-hmm. and I've never heard the information you guys have put out here. And he said, but you've demonstrated it's true, it's evidentiary, it's factual, and it identifies a major threat in this country that we're not addressing. And he then used, as I mentioned in the book, some very colorful language because he was angry. And he was angry that he was realizing that the leadership was not teaching this inside the FBI and DHS. So I asked the entire audience, I said, will you raise your hand if you knew this before you came in here today? And I am not kidding you, not a hand went up. And here's why this is devastating to our national security is these very, and I will tell you, very dedicated men and women who work every day to do the right thing did not know the first thing about an imminent and identifiable threat to this country in the form of the Islamic movement. And what I find is the people at the ground over the last several years are coming to understand the threat, while the leadership, political, certainly military, civilian agencies, they are absolute. They're not only, as you said, they're not just ignorant. They are willfully keeping this information from their people. When I was an FBI agent, after I did the very first two-week program inside the government, which was a resounding success. We had the U.S. Attorney's Office there. We had the Department of Justice, the number two guy for counterterrorism at DOJ there. We had all these same different agencies, 50 people for 2 weeks. And when I got back, one of the things a very senior person in the Bureau did, we had a little friction because he was not real happy about me pointing out the enemy. And he said, look, you're right. Is that what you want to hear? You're right. And he said, now shut up. And he inserted an explicative into that statement. Right. And he told me to shut up. And I just said, this isn't about me being right. Yeah. This is about us swearing an oath to the Constitution to protect and defend it. And what you're telling me is I'm right, but I need to shut my mouth. There's no way that's going to happen. There's no way. And of course, that created a lot of friction for me inside the Bureau. But that's where we are today. So you're hitting the nail right on the head.
Yeah, it's the it is the great tragedy in America that not only is the truth not discussed, the truth is the enemy. The government of this country, its politicians, and those in law enforcement, as well as those in the U.S. military, as well as those in the media, have deemed the truth to be their most formidable enemy. And anyone who speaks it is either told to shut up, or they are publicly crucified. John, I hope you stay with us. We'll have a long segment after this commercial break, and we'll continue to nail more nails in this coffin so that people are aware that their government is lying to them. Chattery Miss, we're having a conversation with John Guandolo. John has written a book called Raising a Jihadi Generation. And you can buy his book at Amazon.com or UnderstandingTheThreat.com. John has affirmed from the inside something that I've shared with this audience now for 2 years, which is that the world in general, but the United States in particular, at every level, whether it's judicial, whether it is political, whether it's military, whether it is academic or the media, is absolutely opposed to associating Islam with terrorism. And yet, you know, John, I wrote a book called The Islamic Terrorism Timeline. I looked at every terrorist event starting 1960 through 2004. I stopped in 2004 because it just got to be too massive and the project grew wearisome. But I look at every terrorist attack from 1960 to 2004. And what I found is you go back to 1960, which is kind of the rise of OPEC. At that time, about a quarter of terrorist attacks in the world were Islamic in origin. And then over time, by the time you reach the 1990s, it's about 85% of terrorist attacks are being perpetrated by Muslims. You have, at that point, about 15% are perpetrated by socialist secular humanists, various communist and socialist movements, even environmental movements. But by 2000, it's 99.9%. If you look at every terrorism act in the world, you get to the point where 99.9% of terrorist acts are perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims, and there's literally thousands of Islamic terrorist groups that they ascribe to. The only common denominator is Islam. And so with that kind of evidence, how in the world do you prevail in an alleged war against a tactic if you haven't got a clue who is using that tactic 99.9% of the time?
Well, first of all, thank you for that's a great lead-in, and it's also I appreciate your research very much, and I will say it's accurate. From all the research I've done, I concur with your conclusion. Now, the question is, and again, if we recall that the objective of the Islamic movement is to impose Islamic law on the world, Sharia, and that it's their blueprint for how they do things, what I have demonstrated inside the intelligence apparatus of the United States is that you can do predictive analysis. And what I mean by that is you will know what they're going to do before they do it because Sharia requires them to tell you. Mm-hmm. Now, that may sound absurd to your listeners, like why would they do that? Because it's a requirement of Sharia. That's why, and that's all you need to know. Why is that important? Well, first of all, let me step back because you mentioned OPEC. Islamic mm-hmm. law only requires them and obliges the Islamic movement or the community to wage jihad when they have the strength mm-hmm. and ability to do so.
Correct.
To wage jihad when you are weak is actually not jihad.
Correct.
Because you're going to lose, and to lose a jihad is not jihad. That's a criminal act.
Right. Can I interrupt you just one second here? Because
yes,
I'm going to support something that you're saying and help our listeners have a chronology here. Prior to the OPEC monopoly and the Islamic warlords throughout the Middle East seizing American and European oil assets, the problem with Islam is that it's such a horrid religion and way of life that there was no prosperous Islamic country. And so they had no means to export jihad. But with OPEC, they became fabulously wealthy, particularly the Sauds. And the Sauds, more than any other group, began to build mosques and to export and to fund Islamic jihad worldwide. And with money, with wealth, they were now in a position where they could buy advanced weaponry and where they could fund jihadi operations. And so that's the reason why OPEC was mentioned in the 1960s. It's what's changed the equation as it relates to Islamic terrorism.
That's right. And we have numerous, and I mean a mountain of evidence, everything from congressional testimony to investigations regarding individual leaders in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi mm-hmm. government and intelligence reports of how much, not only money, but assistance the Saudis give to jihadis so mm-hmm. long as they operate outside the kingdom.
Right.
So inside
Correct.
The kingdom, the Saudis are always glad to give the United States a hand, and we look at that and see they're assisting us. And this is a big thing because you have to understand Islamic law, exactly as you just said, requires them only to wage jihad when they have the strength and ability to do so. To take actions that would bring harm onto the Muslim community, like trying to wage jihad when you're weak, is actually a capital crime under Sharia, and Muslims will be put to death for that. It's one of the few things that, against Muslims where they're going to be put to death for that. So let's step back into the predictive analysis side of this. The group I was with prior to forming my own consulting firm was called the Strategic Engagement Group. And we were just two of us, and then we brought a third gentleman on board while I was working very closely with the Department of Defense and others inside the government after I left the Bureau. And And in November of 2010, we briefed members of Congress that within the next, 60 to 90 days, there would be a massive revolution in the Middle East, would start in Egypt, would proceed across the broader Middle East and the Arab world. It would get to Syria, and the Syrian government would not be overthrown. We explained why. And, of course, as you know, in January 2011, that's exactly what happened. And technically it started a few days earlier in Tunisia, but Egypt was the big one, and then it spread across the Middle East, even into threatening Saudi Arabia, which we predicted. But because the Sauds put out literally billions of dollars to Muslim Brotherhood leaders across the kingdom and also put troops in cities where they thought the riots would begin, it was quelled. But the Brotherhood had called for a day of rage in Saudi Arabia. And why do I bring this up? Well, I bring this up because, number one, a couple months after this revolution, actually it was February, the director of Central Intelligence, Leon Panetta, testified that they had no knowledge, no visibility, were his words, of the revolution, and yet we briefed it to members of Congress 2 months earlier. And I want to say it's not, and we were the only ones in the country that did that, by the way. The question is, how is that possible? Well, it's very possible if you actually read what they say, listen to what they say, and take them at their word. As I mentioned, Islamic law requires them to tell you what they're going to do. It's the way it is. Yeah. And when you understand it, then you can actually do predictive analysis, and we could actually defeat them if we actually listened to what they were saying.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. When they're talking to the West, they're lying most of the time. When they're talking to one another, while they're not telling the truth, they're at least accurately conveying what they intend and what they believe. Now, the difficulty here is that Islam is a lie from top to bottom. Islam is there's nothing in Islam that is true. So when they're conveying Islam to one another, they're lying to one another, but they're accurately conveying what they believe. What my issue has always been, that if you want to defeat Islamic terrorism, what you need to do is to read the Quran and Hadith. And that once you read the Quran and Hadith, that is their playbook. That is their constitution. It tells you exactly what they're going to do, why they're going to do it, when they're going to do it, what means they'll use to do it. Predicting what's going to happen amongst Muslims is extraordinarily easy.
Yes.
And yet we have this disease in America called political correctness that will not allow a open and honest discussion about the nature of the motivation of the disease of the religion that is motivating 99% of terrorist attacks.
Yes, and you just said something that I think I just want to expound on. One of the things is sometimes they are speaking truth about what they believe, mm-hmm. and it's actually true when they speak it to us, but because we don't understand the filter we have to use when we're listening is Sharia, we don't understand it. And let me just give your audience a couple examples. When we hear for instance, you'll see after an attack or an arrest, they'll stand up a leader of generally a Muslim Brotherhood, you know, Islamic Society of Boston, for instance, a Muslim Brotherhood entity founded by an Al-Qaeda guy, by the way, where one of the, Boston bombers attended, or any of the other jihadi attacks in the United States in the last 10 to 15 years. They stand up and they say something like, you know, we denounce terrorism, and we call for the spread of human rights and the protection of all innocents. Well, see, that most Americans hear that, and they go, well, see,
we want,
except right. when you define these terms, you have to define correct. Them only as they define them through Sharia. And, of course,
let me stop you right there, John, because I want to make another comment here.
Okay.
You're very close. You're closer to being accurate than anyone that I have the opportunity to interview on this program. But just as the Muslim Brotherhood is a symptom of Islam, Sharia, too, is a symptom of Islam. Sharia law did not exist when Muhammad created Islam in the 7th century. The oldest books of Sharia law date back to around the 12th century. In fact, you stated that in your opening. Sharia law is a compilation of Muhammad's words and deeds. And so if you take, I know this is difficult because you face so much rejection when you've even used Muslim Brotherhood, and then when you go to Sharia, because you're getting much closer to the root when you use Sharia. But the real problem is that Sharia is composed entirely of the Quran and Hadith. Everything you're saying here is based upon what the Quran and Hadith say. And you go right to the root cause, right back to Muhammad, and that Muhammad, it is impossible to be a Muslim, according to the Quran and Hadith, and not be a jihadist. That's what Islam itself in the Quran and Hadith teaches.
Okay, I don't disagree with that. That's true. But that's what Sharia is. It comes from the Quran and the Hadith. So you and I are not disagreeing. I just, you know, when we talk about this, and especially when I talk about it with individuals that have no knowledge of the threat and no knowledge or very little knowledge of, Islam. In the West, we have a very hard time believing that anyone could be could follow or want to follow a doctrine like what you're describing.
Right.
So I do believe.
So you define it in legal terms as opposed to religious terms, because it makes it easier for Americans to understand that there are doctrines that say you're rewarded in paradise if you're a mass murderer. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. This will be our last segment with John for today, but I hope we'll have the opportunity to have John back. It really is an interesting discussion. And John, if you want to buy John's book, it's Raising a Jihadi Generation. It's available at Amazon.com or Understanding the Threat. John, what we're talking about here is really an interesting migration. When you were part of the team, you discovered that the team itself, particularly the higher level, wasn't willing to tell the truth. A lot of good people at the lower level, but they were not getting the truth. And so as you began your study as to what really is the root cause of this terrorism that we claim to be fighting a war on, you found, well, if you go back, it isn't really Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is kind of a meaningless organization, especially today. And you went to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the wellspring from which Al-Qaeda came. In fact, Azam, the founder of Al-Qaeda, was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He is an Egyptian. Actually, he's a so-called Palestinian. And then your research took you one step beyond that, which is that the Muslim Brotherhood is based upon the Sharia law and the imposition of Sharia law. And, of course, I think you know, in fact, you stated, that Sharia law is based entirely on the Quran and Hadith and, therefore, on Islam. But each time you go closer to the root cause of all of this, the more particularly people in government and the judicial branch and the like want to rebuff you. That's the more they're uncomfortable hearing this. So I'm almost hearing you say, yes, it's true what you're saying, but if we say it that bluntly, people will reject it out of hand. So if we blame it on Islamic law as opposed to the Islamic religion, they're a little more comfortable to receiving the truth.
Right, and I think the question is, what's our goal? And I won't ask you that. For me, I know. What is my goal? My goal is to uphold the oath I took to the Constitution. And if in the way I communicate the threat, people shut down right away, understanding that some people will never get it. They don't want to get it. They're not capable of getting it for a whole host of reasons. They just can't believe people are bad. They're not smart enough. Mm-hmm. They're actually bad people themselves. I mean, there are a whole host of reasons. Mm-hmm. But what I find mostly is that good, well-intentioned people just have a hard time believing, number one, that it's true, because they've grown up hearing the exact opposite.
Correct.
Many of them know Muslims, and they're like, but they wouldn't do that. And so they have a hard time wrapping their brains around it. And the other reason is, I think, because people have a hard time believing that there's such a concerted effort and that we're this far down the road. I mean, I have had, senior people literally in tears, cops and generals, and like, how did we get here that the Muslim Brotherhood has this level of control inside our country and this kind of an infrastructure? So I think there are a lot of reasons. My goal is to share the truth. I get it. I understand the Hadith, and I teach this. And when I teach it to law enforcement, military personnel, we do get there, and we go right to the source documents. But we walk them down into it, and we begin with evidence in legal cases. And then we say, well, let's look at what they got, the guy, you know, Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, or the 9/11 hijackers, or the Boston bombers, or the jihadi, you know, the Virginia Five guys, or the Little Rock shooter, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do all of them say? What did Ayman Zawahiri, what does he say? What did Zarqawi say? What do all these guys say? They say we are Muslims waging jihad in the cause of Allah, meaning waging jihad in the cause of Allah in order to impose Islamic law. And if we just start there and say, okay, are they right or are they wrong? Does Sharia actually say it? And when you go to publish Sharia, it actually says it. And it says it because the Quran commands it and Muhammad did it. And Muhammad's the most perfect example of a man. That's the fact. And there's no getting around it. But as you've mentioned today, facts in a very relativistic world, politically correct, you can call it whatever you want, in a world that has a hard time believing there's black and white, this discussion, a very tough discussion about a very serious threat, becomes even more convoluted when we say that somehow the legal and political system of Islam is really no worse or better than communism or a constitutional republic, and who are we to judge? Well, then you've really led yourself down a road where we can't win, because then if that's true, why is this Republic?
Yeah, we go and squander $4 trillion and thousands of our sons and daughters' blood, making bad situations worse in Afghanistan and Iraq. We engage on the wrong side in Syria and Libya and Tunisia and Egypt because we don't understand the root cause of the problem. And so long as we're lashing out at a religion with bullets and bombs and fighting a symptom, which is a tactic, we will continue to lose this war. Thank you, John. I hope to have you back another day.
Thanks. I would appreciate it.